This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. And today we are honored to have Luke Mann with us. Luke Mann is a media studies scholar based in Aotearoa, New Zealand. His research investigates the sociocultural impacts of digital cultures and their broader intersections with race, politics, and the environment. This wide-ranging work spans from Hong Kong protests to Uber, labor, and far-right radicalizations, and has been featured in highly regarded journals such as Cultural Politics, Big Data and Society, and Information, Communication, and Society, as well as popular forums like The Guardian and The Washington Post. He has written three books, Unmaking the Algorithms in 2018, Logic of Feeling 2020, and Automation is a Myth 2022. And this is the book we are talking about today. The book was just published this year by Stanford University Press. Luke, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Yeah, kia ora koutou katoa. And before I begin, I do want to just acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that I'm on, which is Meanjin or Brisbane, and pay respect to the elders past and present.
Thank you very much. Look, I myself work in an area which is about workforce development, and I always hear things such as Industry 4.0, digital transformation, automation. Automation is going to make 30% of jobs redundant. We have all these big headlines, and they're not the new things, because back in 1970s, the name escapes me, President of the United States, Kennedy, even said that automation will replace a lot of jobs. So before get into these discussions, can you briefly introduce yourself and tell us how this book came about and talk about your research expertise, which is not, you do discuss the important aspects of automation, which is usually swept under the carpet or ignored.
Yeah, great. So I'm a research fellow at the University of Queensland, their Digital Cultures and Societies Hub there. I've just moved recently, and this book really came about because I'd been looking at automation, new technologies, and particularly how they shape work, and that's something I've been interested in for quite a while. So my earlier books are sort of around the gig economy and platform labor, these kinds of questions, and so I did start writing this essay about these kind of myths around automation and how they really prevent us from actually understanding what's actually going on, right, with new technologies kind of on the ground. And that sort of developed and had legs and, really just kind of ran with it in a way and pitched to Stanford University Press, which really liked it as well. And as I sort of developed research more, I found more and more examples of these kind of human stories where, we don't have full automation, but we have this sort of partial piecemeal thing happening where humans are often propping up these so-called automated systems in particular ways. And it really seemed to capture a lot of the issues with automation, with kind of the future of work, or really the present of work, right, in a way. And so the book essentially like pushes back against this, these kind of grand narratives about automation in order to develop a more detailed portrait of kind of work conditions on the ground and help us to understand what's actually going on there.
So in your research, you have visited different sites and you have talked to people as well. Am I right? So can you talk maybe about the sources you used to put this book together?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to draw on quite a lot of different disciplines. So my background is really media studies, but I often draw on like political science and history, race studies, cultural studies, psychology in different aspects. So I try to use those insights from those different disciplines in order to give us a better understanding of these like, technical phenomena. And the way they really shape everyday life and the way they kind of fallout, I guess, human fallout, right, in terms of lives and livelihoods and how they change the way we're working and playing and living. In terms of material, I really drew on a lot of different worker stories for this book. So things like Reddit forums, things like investigative journalism, where journalists would go into things like Amazon, warehouses, and things like these sort of ethnographic accounts of like being a picker, Amazon picker, which we've had a couple of those now. And then also looking at other places outside the US. So one of the projects I was working on as a researcher was this project on automation within China. So looking at Alibaba warehouses and logistics, and thinking about how that kind of automation really was quite different in some ways to what we're seeing in the US, and particularly sort of shows the issues, right, with having this kind of universal sweeping claims about automation. So I drew on quite a lot of that material in parts of the book to kind of show how automation plays out really differently in different spaces.
And the title of the book is quite provocative in terms of the other reports we see here in Automation is Everywhere, but you simply say automation is a myth. And I do encourage our listeners to just check out the book on a website and see the cover, which is, I really like it. It's simple, but it kind of attracts your attention. So when you say automation, how do you define automation in your scope of research? And I'm sure you don't mean it's a complete myth. Of course, there are automated technologies. But what do you mean when you say, because you do talk about like piecemeal changes rather than totally drastic changes with regards to automation. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So it is like a hook, right? This provocation about automation's myth, arguments on the cover, right? And I kind of wanted that sort of provocation as a way to draw the reader in, and especially sort of students, grad students, and who are one of the kind of audiences for this book. So it's a kind of argument up front. And the argument really is not that, of course, that, technologies don't alter work conditions in any way. Of course they do, but really that this automation rhetoric that we've had, right, over the last 100 years, the rhetoric that we see in newspapers and magazines and tech journalism and so forth, it's been around for a long time. And this rhetoric of this sort of grand narrative where automation will replace all the jobs and take over from the human, whoever that is, and sort of sweep across the globe, that rhetoric, that grand narrative is a myth because it's something that really distracts us or prevents us from understanding what's happening on the ground. So for one, just to gloss the kind of the sections, for one, I think it prevents us from seeing that automation, is piecemeal, right? It's partial. And these so-called automated systems are often propped up by a lot of human labor. And secondly, it's a myth because it talks about, it's kind of a sweeping the globe, this idea that automation will take place in the same way in every location, Whereas what we know from cultural studies, from area studies, and so on, is that we have very different conditions in different places. And technology gets taken up or lands really in certain ways in different places and gets used quite differently, right? So that something like automation in India looks very different from something like automation in the US. And then thirdly, this automation myth really has talked for a long time about the human and mankind and what will happen to mankind, right? And in that sense, it gives this figure of the human. And that figure really obscures the fact that labor is racialized and gendered, right? So these impacts will not happen to all humans equally. They will happen to some humans more than others. And what we really see when we look at contemporary work and the ways in which technologies are rolling out is that certain populations, certain people groups bear the brunt of that impact, right? So women, immigrants, people of color, and so on. Really take the impact of automation in very particular ways, and so the human then obscures the kind of the way that racialized and gendered dynamic plays out, and so that's why automation I say is a myth, and really, like I said earlier, it's not about debunking this myth and just breaking it down, but it's a way of as a kind of springboard, right? So by pushing back against this myth, we can then actually dig into the conditions, race conditions or geographical conditions or this sort of more detailed portrait and use that to develop a kind of more nuanced understanding of how actually technologies are altering labor conditions.
That was an excellent explanation. It sort of covered the next question I wanted to ask you. And perhaps I should have mentioned it at the beginning that the book kind of, maybe debunk is not the right word as you mentioned, because you draw our attention to other aspects of automation that we tend not to think of because of all those grand narratives such as race, gender, geography. So you discuss three myths, the myth of automated autonomy, the myth of automation everywhere, the myth of automating everyone. Now, you kind of touched upon some of the socio-material realities that are sort of divorced from real experiences of people in different parts of the world. One thing I liked about the book, and that's something you also discuss in your, you mentioned in your introduction, is that we tend to think of automation as an apolitical phenomenon. It's just automation. It's a good thing, but be careful because it's going to make jobs redundant. So what are some of the dangers that are associated with conceptualizing automation as a completely apolitical phenomenon?
Yeah, I think absolutely. That was what we see really in a lot of tech rhetoric, particularly, and also when we look at like business journals, management rhetoric, and so on, is that we get a certain kind of set of values that are often prioritized, right? And that's things like productivity, things like efficiency, things like speed, right? And so, and these values then are really hard to argue against, right? Who can be against efficiency, right? It seems like very common sense and something that everybody would want. But I think what media studies and what this book in particular is trying to do is really show how that rhetoric launders a set of technologies, a set of values in particular ways, right? So it plays into the incentives of particular companies, tech companies, plays into a particular framing of labor, which is quite disembodied. And it's all about speed and optimization and so on, where really workers don't feature in this conversation at all. One of the quotes in the book that I use from a black activist who's been involved in unions is that it's really bizarre that automation talks a lot about work but never about workers, right? You have these things about labor pool, or about optimizing certain procedures or processes, but these often obscure the kind of impacts on individual workers and the kind of negative experiences they might have, right? So that's why we need to sort of repoliticize automation. And by political here, we're not talking about parliaments and politicians. We're really talking about power relations, right? So who has power? Who gets to speak? Who must be silent? Who gets to make decisions? And, you know, some of the workers in the book, they talk about the fact that they're not necessarily against technology in the workplace, but they do want to have a seat around the table, right, when it comes to being a stakeholder, making decisions, you know, obtaining some of the maybe some of the profits, right, from these new streamlining procedures. So in that case, it's really about repoliticizing this topic and thinking about workers' rights and these kinds of issues.
Because in a little while, we'll be talking about some specific examples of how these the labor of these workers is sort of made or rendered invisible. So you again, you talk about gray literature, which you discussed earlier, but can you describe, there was this example in your introduction that I really loved. Can you describe some of these maybe manual tasks that that sort of, you know, form the basis or the foundations of these so-called digital operations, which we don't really see?
Yeah, sure. So I dig into a few of those in a couple of the chapters in the book. It really is a way to show, again, the sort of human army of labor that often props up these so-called automated systems. So we've already talked a little bit about things like warehouse picking, right, where humans are still pushed in many ways to the breaking point in order to match the kind of metrics that are expected of them when we do warehouse picking of items and delivering of those. I also talk about sort of more obscure or overlooked forms of labor. So things like content moderation, which has got quite a bit of research more recently, I would say. So there's huge amounts of people who work in this space. So content moderation, of course, is done for large social media companies. And content, of course, is key for these companies. Without a sort of stream of interesting, engaging, and safe content, these platforms die, right? So they need some way of ensuring that that content is not toxic, not hateful, and so on. But machines really struggle to make those kinds of decisions. These are actually quite ambiguous decisions a lot of time, right? Distinguishing between what is nudity, what is hate speech versus what is slang, what is something that is kind of maybe ethnographic or particular to an area versus something that is seen as abusive. These are actually really difficult decisions that require a lot of context awareness. And that's something that algorithms have really struggled with in the past and still struggle with. And so these companies then still rely on huge masses of humans to carry out filtering and moderation. And that really comes with a huge human cost, right? So what we're talking about is essentially people being subjected to watching these videos over and over again, videos of abuse, of rape, of violence. And we've seen quite a few stories now then of moderators who talk about the kind of trauma really that they're internalizing as a result of that, the fact, the ways that they go home and drink or cry and just try to recover in time for the next morning's shift, right? And so that's why I call them sort of the HazCam workers of the digital world, where a lot of these sort of affect of trauma gets offloaded to these people who then have to deal with it. And that's a sort of growing sphere of labor in many ways, what Grand Siri called ghost work. So the sort of hidden labor that often props up our systems. There's another brief example. We can look at AI and machine learning and the data required of these systems then requires a lot of cleanup, requires often quite manual labeling of data, right, to determine if something goes in one category or another, or determine, you know, what's a street, what's a car, what's a pedestrian, and so on. And all that can be done to some extent by machines, but often the more detailed, nuanced, context-sensitive stuff really requires human workers. And so, again, you have this sort of huge army of human laborers, often in the global south, who are forced to work for pennies per task, carrying out this data cleaning, data generation kind of work, which really feeds into today's modern AI models. So those are kind of some quick examples then of the human labor that props up our so-called automated systems.
Yeah, I remember a couple of weeks ago, I was going back home with my friend and we saw some of these e-scooters that are all over Melbourne, and I'm sure it's the same in Brisbane. And he told me, I wonder how they manage to find these scooters, how they bring them back to the city, or it's just people finding them. But I think it's in the middle of the night, right? I think that's the example you also have in your book. The people, right, who just drive around the city, pick up these scooters, and then bring them back to CBD again.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's an example in the introduction chapter, and it's just a brief example, I think. But you know, I talk about, you know, someone scrambling to pick up these bicycles and place them on a trailer. They hurt their back a little bit when they stretch to grab something. They sort of work up a sweat, and they get a little bit frustrated, but also they're proud in some ways that they can carry out this work quite quickly and do a good job. And it's just a short story, but I think it's, you know, it's really helpful to get an example like that because it really shifts the paradigm, right? It shifts the narrative. Rather than this kind of 10,000-foot view of automation, we get quite a different kind of portrait at the coalface, as it were.
Let's talk about the myths. There are three myths to discuss in the book. The first one is the myth of automation. The myth of automation is everywhere. The first one is the myth of full autonomy and why full autonomy is never attained. You have touched upon this, you know, as we were talking a few minutes ago, but you have this really interesting term there, digital underclass. And then you go on to discuss something called dark content, which you briefly alluded to a few minutes ago. And your case study is Eva and Franco Maps. So can you talk about, so this full autonomy, you did mention why it's not never really fully attained. What is or who is a digital underclass? And can you talk about your case study there in terms of dark content?
Sure. Yeah, so the myth of full autonomy is this idea that automated technologies will soon replace human labor altogether. And so the problem will then be that we have no work to do or we have too much time. And this is really a long-standing myth that we can actually trace over the course of the last century. We see it coming up over and over again in different headlines and newspapers. And in the chapters then I sort of discuss why that's not happened. So we get this promise, but the promise is never realized, right? And there are various reasons, I think, why that happens. I mean, very briefly, we could say that one of the reasons is that work is really rich and really nuanced, sophisticated kind of space. All when you think about the sort of umbrella of all the things that we put under work. We talk about all the kind of gestures involved, all the cognitive labor, all the affective labor. And machines have really struggled then to adapt to all those different kinds of tasks. And machines have historically been good at this kind of routinized work, right? Work which is very regular, which is predictable. And even when we look at contemporary AI models, they excel in very narrow spaces, right? So they work in a particular domain, And they can often work quite well in that very restricted domain. But then when you try to translate them across to other disciplines, other domains, other problems, they often fall down, they fail. And so in that sense, even our contemporary AI models are not as flexible as like a toddler is, who's able to understand situations very quickly and able to transfer their knowledge to different kinds of problems. And for many other reasons, then we see the ways in which this ideal of full automation is never realized. Right. And so then we start then to talk about spotty automation or piecemeal automation, things that are partially automated. And so rather than this kind of either this utopia or dystopia where humans are, you know, made redundant, what we get is a kind of purgatory in a way where we're sort of caught between these two dreams. And so some things are partially automated, but they also break and they need maintenance and fixing. They need humans to prop them up. Humans then, like in the self-checkout example in the book, you know, humans are then forced to become like security guards, right, in a way. Their capabilities and requirements then change in particular ways. And so we get this sort of half automation space that you know, creates new pressures, I think, on the worker, and that in itself is worth paying attention to. But it's quite different from the sort of utopias and dystopias that we were promised. And yeah, in that digital and underclass example, then I've talked a little bit about already this kind of gray work, this click work and crowdsourced work. A lot of that, I think, would fall in this idea of the digital underclass. But one of the key arguments, I guess, from those chapters I really wanted to stress was that it comes quite late in the chapter, and it essentially says that what we're starting to see then is that automation does erase the worker in the sense of the full worker with a full-time job, a kind of career with full-time benefits, right? That kind of classic mid-20th century understanding of a worker is something that is increasingly rare, right, in today's labor regimes. And what we get instead then is a kind of casualized or flexible or just-in-time worker who operates on tasks for very low rates. And we see sort of work versions of what's called digital piecework, right, where we almost see like this revision to work from a couple hundred years ago where you're trying to crank out tasks from your bedroom, from the internet cafe, and so on, and you're getting paid per piece. And this is a form of work that labor activists really tried for decades to abolish, and in some sense were really successful in doing, right, in order to improve work conditions and get better wages and salaries and rights and so on. And so in some ways it's quite bleak, but what we do see is sort of reversion to older forms of labor exploitation as a result of these digital technologies.
A few months ago, I got a message on my LinkedIn account. There was somebody, I'm not going to mention a specific country, from Global South. It's basically the idea of digital freelancers. So if you have any work, you can outsource it to people somewhere in Sri Lanka, for example, or India, or in Africa. They would do the same job and you can pay less than you would pay, for example, in Europe or in Australia or in America. And there's this other company which acts as a mediator between you and that freelancer. And the freelancer still gets a little bit more maybe than what he would be paid in his country. But again, to me, it looked like another sort of exploiting this army of freelancers or invisible, let's say, digital underclass maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we do see different examples of that in different places increasingly. And what's interesting, one small, I think, point here is that we do see it in the global south, but also I think in more precarious workers in the global north as well. So, you know, there are actually a lot of workers on Amazon Mechanical Turk, for example, who are based in the U.S. And so these workers are carrying out work for very low wages. And what's interesting is that workers in India actually complain about the unequal conditions where workers in the U.S. apparently get better paying jobs, even though they're still poorly paying, right? So we see, again, this sort of digital divide, forms of, like, the global, like, division of labor coming back up, where essentially it's, like, forms of coloniality reappearing once again, right, where you have workers in the Philippines or in India, Sri Lanka, and so on, doing work for companies who are based in Palo Alto or California or the UK and so on. So this sort of classic division of labor or labor exchange.
And that's the third myth I get, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Let's talk about the second myth, that automation is everywhere. And regardless of geography, automation will operate in a similar manner everywhere. And you discuss examples of automation in, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Xinjiang, and why understanding cultural context is important. Can you talk about that myth?
Sure. So, yeah, automation is everywhere is something that we see repeatedly in the automation literature over the last 100 years. So this is a very kind of universal or generic understanding of automation, where this is a kind of technological development that will sweep the globe, right? And so it's coming for everyone. And everyone must get ready. And so when we look at this rhetoric, then again, we have this very, it's kind of 10,000 foot view where automation, it's implied, will take place in the same way in all locations. And so the second part of the book then again pushes back against this idea and as a way to stress the importance of context and culture. So context and culture, then, we know that they're really important because we do see the ways in which technologies get taken up in very different ways in different places, right? So technology is not something that just kind of lands in the same way everywhere, but it's something that intersects with particular norms, particular values. It often gets adopted or adapted in certain ways, right? So a community will pick up certain features that they really like and then change other features or ignore them. And so you get these sort of so-called global technologies developed by U.S. companies that get utilized in actually strange or unpredictable ways in different places around the world. So the whole point of this part two is to really just make this kind of very simple but quite fundamental point, right, that culture and context matter. And to do that, then I look at these two case studies in Xinjiang, and which is northwest China. So for those who don't know, so Xinjiang is the home of the Uyghur people. So this is a minority people, as opposed to the majority Han people. They share in many ways more in common with those in Tibet or other countries neighboring. And for this reason, there's been this really long-standing kind of oppression of Uyghur people. And so then I look at these two examples of so-called automation. And so the first then is this automated surveillance in Xinjiang region. So this is one of the most, I would say, pervasive and intensive surveillance regimes in the world, meant to kind of keep tabs, oppress, and monitor and manage this minority population. So this involves things like CCTV, of course, but also involves huge amounts of human workers who man the checkpoints, right, who carry out security screenings, who go into people's homes and their places of business and interview them, and then record all that data onto mobile phones, and that data then comes back to this sort of single platform that hopes to centralize all the information about the Uyghur people. And so already then we can see that not only is this not an automated system, there's huge amounts of human labor, but more importantly, I think we can see the way this viewpoint, this stress, right, on culture and context shifts the narrative away from this idea of automated surveillance and to something more like historic racism, right? Systemic racism. So, of course, we have technologies that are carrying out these kind of operations, which are part of this. But this whole surveillance regime really dovetails into this long-standing antipathy, right, between these two people groups and into this long-standing oppression of the Uyghur people. And so what we get then is that these technologies really they really prove something that was already suspected, right? That the Uyghur is this abnormal person, this deviant, this someone who's a problem, who is going to create issues in society, who's harboring something already, right? So we get this sense, this form in which technologies confirm what this cultural context already suspected, right? And in that sense, then I think it's really productive to shift away from this pure technology view to think about forms of historical and systemic racism. And then the second case study that you mentioned, again, focuses on Xinjiang, but looks at cotton harvesting. So cotton harvesting is really key to the region. It's actually one of the largest cotton production regions in the world, and is really renowned for its high-quality cotton. And, you know, they talk about the fact that cotton harvesting is a very difficult job. It's very taxing. It's brutal. And in recent years, then, we see a lot of media by the Chinese state, by sort of tech companies or tech-affiliated companies, which talk about the fact that this cotton production, cotton harvesting is automated, right? So no longer will we have to do this taxing job. We have these huge tractors. We have things like drones that fly overhead that map the fields and so on, and that it's all becoming automated. And so I really dig into this claim and draw on quite a few scholars, Chinese scholars, who have really looked closely at this space in the last few years and shows the way in which it's not automated. It's actually just that this quite invisible group of laborers, the Uyghur people, then are really really coerced into forms of labor exploitation, where they are transported to these fields, right, often far away from their home village, and then they're stuck there essentially to the end of the harvest season. There's no escape in any real sense. They're often paid far below what was promised, and then forced to carry out this kind of backbreaking work from sunrise to sundown. And so what we see then is not automated harvesting, but this kind of, again, this sort of leveraging, right, of this cultural relationship, where we see the incentivizing the systemic deployment of low-paid ethnic minority workers. And so in that sense, is then I think these two case studies really foreground the ways in which we get a lot of new insights or better insights, right, from sort of sidelining or augmenting technology with these cultural and contextual understandings.
I think a couple of years ago, I saw this report, which was actually released in Australia. This was about how political prisoners in China are forced into labor for big companies, car manufacturers, which again sort of it resonated. I mean, I was reminded of that when you were talking about this surveillance, this sort of surveillance capitalism there. The third myth you discuss in your book, and this personally I found it the most fascinating one because I've never thought about automation and how it's blind to gender. So it's the myth of automating everyone. I have a couple of questions for this part. So can you first tell us broadly how is automation blind or oblivious to issues of race or labor? Because labor is a very, again, it's a very complex and stratified phenomenon. The industrial relations, the labor relations differ from country to country. But can you tell us why or how, in what ways, automation is blind to these issues of race and gender and labor?
Yeah, so again, when we look at the automation rhetoric from the last 100 years, what comes up repeatedly is this phrase of automation and man, right? Or automation and the human. And that's something that, you know, we could dismiss as something, I mean, it's like 60s language or something, right? Sort of more patriarchal language. But actually, when we look at even more recent reports of automation, we see this very generic figure of the worker, right? So workers are referred to as sort of a labor force or a pool of laborers, right? And so even more detailed reports about automation, you know, I go through them and you can see that they only include like women two times over 50 pages or something. So there's no really detailing of who this worker is and why particular workers have different kinds of conditions than other workers. And so again, I push back against this myth and talk about this idea of the human. So the human, especially when we draw on race studies and cultural studies, human is a term that hides a lot of things, right? Some people get to be human and other people do not. And so historically, then we see the ways in which some people are labeled humans and some are labeled less than human or subhuman and so on, right? And so when you dig into this term of the human and start to look at labor, we can start to see the ways in which labor is really racialized and gendered, right? So automation is not something that emerges overnight, something that slots into this longer labor history, right? And labor history is predicated on essentially the exploitation of some people by other people. Right? That's how racial capitalism works. And so we have this differentiation, which is really key to capitalism. So it's not like everybody is in the same boat. Some people are privileged and other people are dismissed or oppressed or somehow marginalized in particular ways. Right? So all this then is really key. These are like basic errors in some ways, insights, right, from race, cultural studies, political studies, and so on. But they're actually really important to understanding how automation plays out in a space that is already racialized and gendered, right? And all of this means that when we see automated technologies get deployed in certain industries, that it's not a generic figure of the human who is being impacted, right? It's very particular kinds of people, groups, very particular kinds of people. And the people, again, that bear the brunt of this automation in many ways are people who are already marginalized, women, people of color, and so on, and who are already in precarious positions, right? So when we think about wealth, for example, wealth is one way you can become resilient against these technological revolutions, right? These shifts. So if you have a lot of wealth in your family, wealth, of course, being something generational, like it's built up, then you're able then to, if you get fired, for example, you're able then to go back, to take time off, to retrain, to shift careers or whatever. If you have no wealth, as a lot of these groups don't, then you're already far more exposed, right? And so resilience is not something that you're able to leverage in a way. Resilience is something that's privileged. And so, again, when we see these automated technologies play out in the warehouse industry, for example, warehouse industry has really racially uneven, so dominated by people of color, black people in the U.S. particularly, who have been funneled into these positions over the decades, right? So that when we see automated technologies play out on the warehouse floor, then they're going to influence those workers on the warehouse floor differently from the white manager in the office above, right?
Another concept that you bring up in this chapter is masculinization of home automation and feminization of digital assistants. And I really loved it. When I was going through this part, I was reminded of something which might not be directly relevant, but I was reminded of this, an article I'd read some time ago. It was about coffee machines. And when coffee machines were kind of commercialized in 1970s, I guess, before that, making coffee was a woman's job at home. And there were a lot of, and I checked YouTube and it was true, there were a lot of commercials on how a housewife is desperate to get a good coffee to keep her husband happy. And then the coffee machines were invented, and there was this actor, they were commercialized. So there was this baseball player, Joe DiMaggio, in the United States. And again, I checked the YouTube, there are a lot of coffee machine commercials with Joe DiMaggio. So he's the guy, the masculine guy in the kitchen. And he's the only, there are no women in the kitchen. It's just that guy making coffee. And the whole rhetoric of this coffee making sort of changed. And we had this masculine, let's say, army of baristas making great coffee. It was a gender studies, a gender lens put over appliances we use at home. And when I read that part about feminization of digital assistants, it suddenly hit me that, yeah, a lot of digital devices that I use are sort of feminized in a way. Can you talk about that idea of masculinization of home automation and feminization of digital assistants?
Yeah, that's a great example. Joe DiMaggio in the kitchen. so I look at, in the second to last chapter, I look at this feminization, how automation then alters the conditions of work for women. And of course, women don't have universal conditions of work either, so we have to be quite careful with this claim. But there are ways in which we see these kind of gender dynamic play out in terms of automation and technology. So one is, like you said, the feminization of digital assistants. So, you know, digital assistants in many ways could be anything, right? They could be designed in any sort of way. It's quite open-ended. And so it's notable then that with the, really in the last, I would say, 50 years, then we see a range of computer devices and digital assistants that are gendered as female. And so with things like Alexa, and Siri to some extent, and then bots, a lot of chat bots and so on are often gendered female. And this really dovetails into this long history where women are subservient, right? So women are in the domestic space. They are assistants. They are always ready to serve. And So then when you develop these new digital technologies, they take on that role, right, as a way to be friendly, to be open to your command, to be always listening, as Alexa is always willing to help. And so that really leverages this kind of history where then users are more prone, I guess, or more open to giving these commands, right, because they tap into this long history. So women then are moved from being, like the computers, right, in the mid-60s or something, to the computerized version of the female who's always ready to help. And then the other example I give in that section then, when we talk about automation is, there's a couple different ones, but lack of automation is one key thing. So really the home and this reproductive labor being left out of the automation push, right? So the workplace, the masculine workplace is in the office, the factory, and so on. It's historically been the site where automated technologies have focused. And the reason of that is because woman's work is not work, right? Reproductive labor is not labor. And that's the way that we've defined labor in the past. And so bringing these feminist lenses then to think about automation is one way to challenge that assumption and to think about what counts as work, right? And then the final thing in that section I point out is this masculine automation in the home. So, strangely enough, home automation has really been framed as a man's domain. And so a lot of the technologies that we see, I would say in the last 5 years, get rolled out in terms of turning on lights, changing your temperature, opening your garage door, and so on. These kinds of home automation has really been framed as a man's domain, a man's world. And again, we see the ways in which women's concerns get overlooked or marginalized or sidelined in some ways. And in the book, I give a few examples of, guys in home automation forums who complain that their wife is like interfering with their home automation plans, right? It's, and so there's very particular ways in which these automated technologies play out in these gendered spaces.
And in your final chapter, and again it has this provocative heading, automation is not our future, which goes quite against all those headlines where we have automation is the way to go, automation is the future, or arguing against automation is like arguing against the rules of gravity. Automation is not our future. Well, what I liked about your book, as you also mentioned at the beginning, is that it's not really debunking, but it's more drawing our attention to aspects that are not seen or ignored. And let's talk about this chapter. If automation is not our future, what are some of the alternative values or alternative visions we can have? And for those who want to read the book, on page 127, you kind of have around 10, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 10. Let's say principles that you arrive at after doing the research. So can you briefly tell us what is maybe some of the most important ones, talk about the most important ones, and do you all talk about the alternative vision of automation that you have in mind?
Right, yeah. So in that final chapter then, again, I could push back against this inevitable future that's been handed to us by technologists and suggest that actually the future is open-ended and we need plural futures, really, futures that might be determined by different communities and by their needs, right? So you have then different kinds of automated technologies that fulfill the particular needs of particular communities. And it really co-designed by them, I think, in a way. I think that would be one of the ways to go in terms of thinking about technologies and how they might support certain types of diversity and certain types of value. And so in that chapter, I give a few different examples of communities and movements that have pushed back against this, you know, so-called inevitable automated future that we have. One is the Lucas Plan. So in the 1970s, this group of factory workers was, in danger of losing their jobs. The management said that automation would essentially replace them. And so rather than sort of bowing out, the engineers and the machinists in that factory then came up with a new set of products that they might design rather than sort of military industrial products that they had been making before. They would make socially useful products, right? Things for people in society that were more marginalized, right? So people with special needs, for example, that might need like mobility technologies. And in doing so, then they would sort of put their skills, put their huge expertise towards these socially useful projects. And so they came up with this sort of catalog then of things that they might design. And then in the wake of that, they developed these principles that might really shape how automation should play out. And I've sort of adapted those in this chapter. And so they have, you know, quite simple but quite powerful principles, like the fact that you should be able to repair a product, right? The fact that it shouldn't be alienating, so that you should have some sort of connection to a product all the way through to the end of its cycle, and that you should be able to see that it, you know, has some meaning, creates meaning in life as a result of your work. These technologies should be visible and understandable to workers, right? So you should be able to understand or grasp what's going on under the, you know, behind the scenes, and be able to make real decisions that make a real impact in these spaces. And then they've got things like sustainable principles, right? So that we want these automated technologies to be ecologically desirable. They should be made of sustainable processes, and they should, you know, think about the whole life cycle of the product. So what happens at the very end when it's depleted or so on. Right, so they're kind of, in ways, very simple but very powerful as a way to set down the kinds of technologies that we actually want to see in our future. And I give a couple other examples then of modern movements that have really built or sort of, I guess, mirror this kind of work, right? So carry out this sort of debating, discussing about what kind of technologies that we want in our society and how they, what they might look like, right? So one of those is Data for Black Lives. This is a kind of umbrella, loose movement of coders, activists, artists, who have carried out a series of events over the last few years. And really, they give this very different understanding of the kinds of values or kinds of issues that are important when we talk about technologies, right? So rather than just about efficiency or productivity, they talk about things like abolition, things like self-determination, things like autonomy, and how we might sort of embed those in particular technologies. And then the other example I give is this Maui Data Sovereignty Network here in Aotearoa. So this is, again, a loose collection of scholars and researchers who have thought about data and about the importance of data, how data itself is a kind of new technology, and how then indigenous values might guide the development of data, how data is handled, who gets access to data, right? Who gets ownership over the data, how it gets used, what kind of technologies get spun up from that data. And again, these are kind of fundamental questions, but by looking at them from particular community standpoints, particular people's standpoints, we get a quite different understanding of the kinds of technologies and sorts of futures that we might build moving forward.
And I guess one thing that I can think of is that during COVID-19, the adoption of digital technologies skyrocketed. A lot of businesses switched to, even educational institutions switched to digital platforms. And after a few months, they realized they can't just do away with human interaction. And they were really desperate to get back to a sort of a pre-COVID condition in terms of work relations. And even back in 1930s or 20s, if you see, look at some of the posters that futurists of the time, they tried to predict what, for example, 21st century looked like. It was all these kind of bizarre sci-fi predictions, but none of them really came true. And I, like I said, this COVID just, again, emphasized the human element. And I'm hoping that maybe more politicians could be more alert to those aspects of automation that you have brought up in the book. To give everybody a fair go in the adoption of these digital technologies or automation, whatever form or take form or shape it might have in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think COVID and the pandemic was a moment really that shook up a lot of things that were considered to be permanent, right? The status quo, something that was like labor conditions that were often seen as unchangeable. And so all of a sudden then you had by necessity a lot of people moving back home or conducting remote work, a lot of people doing maybe less work, and a different kind of relationship really between employers and employees, different kinds of relationship based on the mediation then of our labor, right? And all of these kind of quite different dynamics that sort of almost overnight, right, occurred, and people were forced to sort of grapple with what this might mean. And I mean, sadly, I think some of that opportunity has been lost a little bit to really, really follow some of those threads. But I think we do see new forms of autonomy and agency that workers have, right? This idea of quiet quitting, this idea that workers will not return to the office if COVID conditions, make it not worth it, and so on, right? So we have this sort of newfound confidence, I think, really from some workers to say, actually, this is what I want from work. These are the kind of conditions that I'll accept. Maybe some more solidarity in terms of a lot of unionization happening right now, Starbucks, McDonald's, Amazon, and so on. Moments that were considered to be really unthinkable, I would say, before, 5 years ago, whatever. So I do think there are really some promising currents, and that if we can think about the sort of futures plural that we want and really have this discussion and contemplation about the kinds of technologies that might support those futures, then we'll be in a better position. Yeah.
Yeah, you just rightly mentioned some of the new, let's say, the new forms of agencies that the worker can. And it's quite interesting that pandemic in general historically has been somehow so also so has triggered like even in medieval times, the peasant revolution came after a pandemic, and even Black Lives Matter pandemic sort of exposed, let's say, the inequalities in work relations or economic disparities. And it was also partly triggered the Black Lives Matter movement as well, and the newfound agency of workers, as you mentioned, examples with Starbucks or Amazon in the United States, which are really, really promising. Dr. Luke Mann, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on New Books Network.
Great. Thanks for having me.